Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. If you've lived in the western United States for decades, as I have, you know that wildfires are a fact of life. But in recent years, our wildfires have gotten bigger, more intense, and in recent years, more deadly. In Northern California, where this show is produced, the Carr Fire devastated the area just west of Redding. And as this is recorded, the Mendocino Complex Fire is the largest in the state's history. There are at least 16 major wildfires burning in the state, stretching our firefighting resources to the limit. Recently, Trump cabinet members visited the Carr Fire. Homeland Defense Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen was followed by Secretary of the Department of Interior Ryan Zinke and Department of Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue. When asked if climate change was contributing to the fires, they mostly deflected on the question as counterproductive. Though to be fair, Zinke did acknowledge that the fire season is getting longer. In this hour, we're going to take a scientific point of view to tackle this issue. We'll talk to three distinguished scientists to find out about what's going on with California's catastrophic megafires. We'll talk to NASA forest fire ecology expert Natasha Stavros about the role fire plays in healthy forest ecosystems and how our understanding of that has evolved over time. Then we'll hear from a forecaster for the National Weather Service office in Sacramento. Eric Kurth will tell us about the role the Weather Service plays in forecasting for both the public and the intergovernmental agencies that fight the fires. Finally, Blue Dot's oceanographer and climate scientist emeritus Bill Patzer joins us to discuss the big picture, how fire is a part of California's past, present, and future, and what possible solutions there are. First, let's talk to Natasha Stavros. Natasha is a scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, where she studies forest fire ecology. She joins us from Pasadena via Skype. Natasha Stavros, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I'd like to get started by, before we really dig deep into what's going on with the wildfires, especially in California this summer, I'd like to know a little bit about your origins. What first got you interested in fire ecology?
Well, I actually started with science doing solar physics, and it was just a little too far removed for me. So I started looking at the Earth, and I was looking for PhD opportunities, and I found a professor online at University of Washington by reading his profile that looked like he did similar work to me. And I contacted him, and he said, "Nope, I don't have any work for you, but my colleague just got a grant and he is looking at fire and air quality. How does that interest you?" And I thought, well, being a girl from San Diego, California, and having my parents have just evacuated in both 2003 and 2007, it was a really personal subject for me. And so that sort of launched my career and thinking about fire ecology more broadly.
Well, let's start out by talking about fire is a natural part of forest ecology. Could you just, you know, give us kind of a little 101 on that?
Sure. Since the 1970s, actually, the story kind of goes back further than that. In the early 1900s, there was a really big fire in Yellowstone, and it's called the Big Burn. And after that, they initiated a 100% fire suppression policy. And it was called the 10 a.m. rule. And that was by 10 a.m. in the morning, any fire that had happened better be out. And if it's not out by 10 a.m., it better be out by 10 a.m. the next day. And they did this for several decades. And then in about the 70s, people started to show sort of scientific evidence that there were certain plant species and plant communities that had grown and evolved to live in a world with fire. And so we have some plant species that have, let's say, cones that won't open unless under extreme heat. Or you have some plants where what's above the soil, kind of like an iceberg, it needs to kind of, it gets really old and it needs to burn. And then actually there's a lot of reserves that are in tubers under the ground. that then replenish the plant and it continues to grow. And so there's different kinds of plants that have different reactions, but at the end of the day, we discovered that there are certain plant communities that really thrive when fire is introduced to the landscape.
That's the old smoky bear policy is what you're talking about, correct?
Preventing forest fire, yes.
And so now we've had this fuel buildup in the Western United States for decades and decades, and which is contributing to these mega fires. So could you characterize for us what's going on like now with these fires in California?
So mega fires actually, they are this sort of unique type of fire. They're very extreme. They typically have a lot of impact to human communities that could be through loss of infrastructure, fatalities, or proximity to beloved and cultured resources. It could be proximity to water. So that's really what makes a megafire a megafire. But they can also be characterized by how fast they move across the landscape and how hard they are to manage. And what we're actually seeing with these sort of megafires that are happening right now, for example, the Mendocino fire in Northern California and in the Ferguson fire. And last year, we had the Tubbs fire in Santa Rosa and the Thomas fire in Santa Barbara. And before that, there was a couple more in Yosemite. We're seeing that these megafire events, although we've typically classified them as extreme and rare, are actually happening more and more frequently. And the community for a long time has had a lot of debates about whether or not the reason for seeing them is because of fuel accumulation from not allowing fire to go on the landscape or from climate. And our most recent research has actually shown that what's driving these really extreme fires is actually the fire itself and the winds that the fire creates, because of the amount of heat that it generates. And that can be sort of more confounded in a complex landscape when there's a lot of mountains. And so as fires are burning really hot and they're burning through these fuels, they're generating more heat and creating this sort of feedback then perpetuates them forward and drives the fuels in front of it.
Yes, and of course, the big fire up in Northern California beyond the Mendocino complex is the Carr fire. And that generated what's being characterized as a fire tornado, which just absolutely obliterated a giant steel structure and twisted it and crushed it like an aluminum can because those winds were so hot and, at a tornadic speeds.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about is that sort of wind generated by the fire itself. And fire tornadoes are something that we've seen for a long time. And actually in Australia, they've been capturing photographs of these fire tornadoes for a long time. But it hasn't been until the most recent year and a half that I've seen footage like that shown here in the United States. And so I think that really goes to show that, in fact, what we've found in our research, that what drives these megafires is their own wind, is that we're actually seeing more people showing these wind tornadoes in these extreme fire events.
One of the studies, you used the term localized winds. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. So there's a couple different kinds of winds that we can be talking about. So for us, for the people who live in California, we are very familiar with something called Santa Ana winds. And those are winds that come off the hot and the dry desert, and they push everything out over the ocean. And most people who live here actually really enjoy it because the air quality gets really clean. And that's what we would call a mesoscale wind, right? It has sort of a regional large-scale impact, and it's because of large atmospheric circulations that is driving those winds. But when we talk about localized winds, we're talking about winds that are just right to the spot that you're talking about, and that's right where the flame is.
And one of the things I read in your study is that we really have had a misunderstanding of the causes of these megafires. Could you just elaborate a little more on that?
Yeah, so a lot of the misunderstanding about these mega fires is because until the last 10 years, these have been very extreme rare events. And so when you think about statistics and you're trying to understand numbers and you have something that's rare, you just have a lot fewer samples. And so it's a lot more uncertain about what drives it. And so the way that mega fires have been studied in the past is through sort of anecdotal experience or through statistics. And the problem with the statistics is that it doesn't really get at the driving mechanisms. So one of the things that we did in the study that you're mentioning is we actually used a fire simulation model that tries to capture the chemistry and the physics of fire and imprint it on the landscape so that we could understand and we could test different scenarios, kind of almost making a control scenario versus the actual scenario and testing to see what the different drivers were. And what we found is that even when we changed the fuel loads, it really didn't make a difference in how the fire behaved unless we were in really extreme environments. And that has to do with the heat and the winds that the fire is generating itself, compounded by the complex terrain.
I'm Dave Shlom, and you're listening to Blue Dot as we talk about catastrophic wildfires in the West. When we come back from a short break, we'll finish our conversation with NASA forest fire ecology expert Natasha Stavros. Stay with us. And we're back. This is Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. Let's continue our look at wildfires in the West. I was watching just coincidentally today on television, the local television station was showing a press conference with Ryan Zinke, who is the Secretary of the Department of Interior, and Sonny Perdue, who's the U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary in charge of the U.S. Forest Service. And the local representative to the House of Representatives, Doug LaMalfa, for this area. And they were talking about the Carr fire. And one of the questions that came up was, when we send these aircraft in to try to bomb these fires with retardants, and we have just an incredible fleet of an arsenal of aircraft, and, you know, California has probably the finest firefighting force in the world. But they do have difficulty to be able to get at these hot spots and places and figure out where they are, especially at night and in smoky conditions. And I'm wondering, what are some of the tools that NASA brings to bear that are some of the technologies that you use to study these fires that you could talk about?
So this is exactly my specialty, thinking about how technology can actually help the current state of the art. And so right now, NASA has several satellites in orbit that are in the thermal infrared part of the electromagnetic spectrum. And what that means is that they can see beyond our eyes. So when our eyes are limited in the visible part of the spectrum because of smoke, we can use thermal infrared that actually sees through the smoke and can tell us where there's hot spots on the ground. Now, there's certain caveats associated with different technologies. The technology that we have that can sit over a fire and just look at the fire constantly every 5 minutes, it's very coarse in resolution, just like when you go to a national park and you want to zoom in really close on a mountain edge far in the distance, it gets very blurry, right? When you have these these satellites that sit very far back from the Earth and can look at one spot without necessarily moving, they also are very coarse and see things kind of blurry. When we have satellites that are closer to the Earth, that can see things at high resolution, they typically can't see them as frequently because they have to actually go around the Earth to come back to the same spot. So that's one way that we're trying to actually think about how do we resolve these differences. And we're exploring some new avenues here at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, but that's still a work in development. So I'll save that for when the technology gets developed.
So yeah, we'll talk to you about that when that comes about. Are these technologies, though, that you can foresee in the not too distant future, the CAL FIRE and the U.S. Forest Service, these aircraft being able to, you know, incorporate into their strategies?
Yeah, so the U.S. Forest Service, the BLM, the National Park Service, all of these agencies actually have a very close relationship with NASA, and we work with them directly to help try and make sure that anything and any observations that we get can be useful for them. And so there have been a number of projects that have been funded by NASA to actually create sort of what we would call value-added products or technology for this community specifically. But everything that I've kind of mentioned so far, the fire managers are actually using. There are certain ways that we could make it more useful. Just like your phone has new versions that come out regularly, you know, there's always room to progress. But I would say that these management agencies are doing the best they can with what's being provided to them. And they really are trying to use everything that is available to help inform them how to manage a fire.
And one of the questions that came up, obviously, in the press conference, at least it seemed obvious to me, is, you know, what is the role of climate change playing on these fires? And you hear this term constantly, the new normal, and all of both secretaries and the really bristled at that. Is like, well, this doesn't need to be normal. We can do things to fix this by better managing our fuels, et cetera. But what role do you think that climate change is playing in these mega fires? Is it playing a role?
Climate change is definitely playing a role. As we've all experienced here in California over the last, well, really the whole summer long, we've had heat wave after heat wave after heat wave. That stresses our plants. We're just coming off of a multi-year drought. And that drought has sort of memory on the landscape and stresses the plants and makes them more flammable or susceptible to burning. My PhD research actually was looking at these extreme events to kind of understand whether or not they're going to be more regular in the future. And what we found is that it's actually variable across the United States. The specific results of this study from my PhD showed that in California, it was about 2 times more likely to have these extreme events than it was in the past, while in Washington State in the Pacific Northwest, it was 4.5 times more likely. So why might there be those variations? And really, if you think about it, fire falls on a spectrum. And you have sort of at one end, you have a fuel-limited system. And the fuel-limited system is one like Nevada. There's not a lot of fuels there. And actually, a good indicator of it burning is to actually have rain, which most people think is counterintuitive, right? But you have to have that rain to grow the fuels to carry the fire. And then you have, on the other end of the spectrum, something that's flammability limited. And that says, we have the fuel, but it's never actually dry enough for the fuel to catch, right? Just like trying to go to the beach and start a fire with a waterlogged piece of wood. And what we're seeing with climate change is that those systems that are flammability limited, they have the fuel, they're becoming hotter and drier. So they're moving more towards that fuel limited system. And we're going to see shifts in the ecosystems as they move in that direction. And so the communities that are already kind of fuel limited are just shifting on the spectrum more in the direction that they're already fuel limited. And so that's why we see variable trends in what we expect to happen going forward in the future.
Well, I'd like to finish up with, what are some things that we can do that in your research and your work there at JPL to address, you know, how can we make this better? How can we better manage this system to where we don't have these extreme events? Are there practical things that we can start really doing about it?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, the first thing is to say that history taught us a lesson, and that's that not all fire is bad fire. Some fire is necessary. And so I think your question is exactly the right question. You know, what can we do to live within this system? How can we live with the system that's naturally going to burn? And I kind of always like to make this point to people is that fire is a very interesting natural disaster because it's the only one that we as humans have a relationship with that we think we can control. You know, we've used fire for cooking, right? So we can control fire for our own means. We've used it as a tool. And therefore, when fire comes on the landscape, we think we can control it. But we don't try to do that for hurricanes, let's say. Instead, we say, well, a hurricane's going to come. How do we build infrastructure so that we're resilient and robust to when it does come? And I think that those are the kinds of questions that we need to be asking going forward is how do we build our communities to be resilient, knowing that fire is going to be there?
Well, on that note, Dr. Natasha Stavros, forest and fire ecology scientist from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, I'd like to thank you for your time. That was really interesting and best of luck with your future research.
Yeah, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to come on your show.
Our next guest is Eric Kurth. Eric is a forecaster for the National Weather Service in Sacramento, California. Their office has been extremely busy making fire weather forecasts for both the public and the agencies that fight the fires. Eric Kurth, welcome to Blue Dot. I'd like to start out by asking you about this year, because it's been just one of the worst fire seasons I can ever remember in Northern California. The smoke has been just brutal here in the North Sacramento Valley. Has there been anything at all unusual about our temperatures and wind patterns leading into this season? Has it been anything at all about it that would have tipped you off that this is going to be a bad fire season?
Well, I think one thing that was kind of remarkable just in general and kind of looking in a longer term is just that we had that severe drought. And even when we came out of it, we had certainly a very wet year, the 2016-17. But this past winter has been more of a mixed bag in terms of precipitation coverage. And some locations like the Northern Sierra got pretty much around a normal level, whereas other portions of the area, especially I would say the western Sacramento Valley and the northern coastal range, actually got substantially below normal. So it was, unlike the winter before where everyone was wet, it was really a mixed bag. So I think that, along with the long-term drought that we had, really stressed a lot of the vegetation. So lots of dead trees and bushes. And some of these areas we've seen the wildfires develop.
Well, let's talk about your role there at the National Weather Service, all of you forecasters. I've been just really struck by, I follow the National Weather Service Sacramento on Twitter, and I get just incredible fire coverage, the retweets of what's going on and all of the fires in California through the National Weather Service. You guys play a really pivotal role in communicating what's going on with these fires, don't you?
Well, we sure try to do that. We try to get whatever information out there on the current fires. We're trying to get information out on the smoke. We have a HERS smoke model, and we try to give people an idea where the smoke is going to be headed and where it's coming from. And some of that's an inexact science. But we try to do what we can, and fire weather can be complex, just everything involved in it. But we want to get out the information to people as quickly as possible, especially if there's something like evacuations or just some higher fire danger. We put out red flag warnings and fire weather watches when we see that the fire weather is going to be particularly hazardous. Just let people know that they really need to be careful in terms of any burning they might do, or even things like vehicles with chains hanging, or parking some all-terrain vehicles on the grass on a hot day. That can touch off a new fire. So we really want to try to help people avoid that and just maintain their own safety as well.
Yes, and it was a vehicle, you know, actually that started the car fire up by Redding, which has, you know, just been one of the most disastrous fires in Northern California history.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, my understanding, there was a trailer that tire blew out, and just the sparks from that started. So it really doesn't take much. Some fires start from lightning, some are intentional, and some are just accidents, just things people probably have no realization that just a few sparks can start just a gigantic blaze. So I think people really need to be aware and stay tuned to when there is a higher fire danger in terms of, you know, like we've seen much of the summer, we had prolonged periods with north winds and a lot of triple-digit heat. The fuels are things like trees and dead wood and grass even, and just a prolonged period of low humidity and heat can make it just like gasoline almost. It just takes a few sparks, and you can end up with a gigantic wildfire.
Can you tell us a bit about the role that you guys play when a fire starts, especially a large fire like the Mendocino Complex and the Carr Fire, the Ferguson Fire down by Yosemite? What role do you guys play in working with the firefighting agencies like Cal Fire and the Forest Service?
Well, we have a few roles there, and one of them is when there is a fire, they contact us. And we do a specific forecast just for that location called the spot forecast. And it's customized for the terrain and vegetation and elevation of that area. So we attune that forecast, try to give the firefighters valuable information for them. It's not a forecast that people would typically see. So it's something behind the scenes, but it's an important role in helping them figure out where the fire is going to spread, how quickly it's going to spread. And it's really pivotal information, I think, for them to get. So we try to get that out right away. And another role we have, too, is where we actually send someone on site to the incident command at the fire so they can actually see the terrain and experience the weather at that site. Sometimes that involves living in tents or just rough conditions, and they may need satellite communication. But we're willing to send people out there who will be out there right in the field with the people running the firefighting effort and try to give them that information right away. So we have quite a few of these, which we call IMETs, incident meteorologists. And they're out there on the fires.
One of the things that I find fascinating is that, you know, weather, of course, affects fires with the dry conditions, especially those dry north winds, high temperatures. You know, all those conditions contribute to when you, for example, use a red flag warning, which lets us know, you know, be very, very careful out there. But also fires generate their own weather, and especially, you know, we saw at the Carr Fire this tornadic wind pattern where it generated these incredible winds. Could you describe that for us a little bit and talk about what conditions cause that?
Yeah, that is an unusual phenomena, and it's something I actually looked at several years ago. I did some research. We had a large fire whirl on the Eiler Fire, which is in eastern Shasta County, and that created something that had low-end tornadic level winds as well, like EF1 level, so a fairly weak tornado, but it did damage the trees. In the case of something like what we had with the car fire, we had an even stronger one that had up to EF3 level damage. And so while not being a tornado, it's damage that would be equivalent to a moderate tornado, EF3 level, or about 143 mile per hour wind was the estimate for the damage. And in the case of the car fire, the winds were not particularly strong. And I think a lot of people are attuned to the idea that strong winds create hazardous fire conditions, which is certainly true. But in the case of the car fire, we did not have really strong winds. They were relatively light. And we ended up with a plume-dominated fire, which is when the winds at the surface are relatively light, but there's a lot of instability. And I think in this case, some extremely dry fuels coupled with that instability created a very strong updraft where the air is rising very rapidly. And the terrain in that area is just something we've seen through the years. The terrain gives sort of a natural rotation to a rising air. And it created a very strong whirlwind, which as that increased, it sucked in more and more air and fed the fire, which created even hotter air. So it fed itself and created very, very strong winds and did quite a bit of damage.
Yeah, I saw that. There was that one image of a steel structure that was just looked like it had been twisted into a like somebody taking an aluminum can and torquing it and crushing it.
Yeah, that was some of the more remarkable damage. So the high tension power towers, which are built very strong, and so it really took some substantial wind to twist that up.
When you saw images of that, as a somebody who's studied this before, were you even surprised by the damage you saw in that?
I was. And like I said, I personally have looked at this phenomenon of the fire whirl and had seen some damage before. But I think the scale of this was remarkable. I've never seen anything quite to that level where it was wrapping a fence pole around a tree or crumpling those towers. And then to see a number of unburned trees and houses damaged, bark stripped off of trees or large trees knocked over. It's really sobering to realize that this phenomenon can get that strong. So I think it's something we're studying more, something we'll be looking into and trying to understand more just how something that powerful can develop.
Well, moving forward, we're only in early August as we have this conversation, and there's a lot of fire season left, isn't there?
That's sure true. Yeah, we're still relatively early into the fire season. Typically, as we're getting into September, you know, it does vary year to year, but typically things tend to get worse at that point because over the summer, you know, the fuels get drier and drier. And we see, you know, more and more fire development. So we'll have to see how things go for the rest of the summer. But I would say that until we get some good rain, we're very much going to be in a heightened fire weather condition. Hopefully those rains come early, but we really don't know at this point. There's no substantial rain in sight. So I think people can just expect that we're going to be in kind of a heightened fire danger level for the next couple months. And I guess, like I said, we'll have to see how things go.
Well, and then finally, once it does start to rain, you know, your next role in terms of these fires is to be giving us alerts about possible debris flows. Could you just quickly address what the dangers are of that going forward?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, when fire season ends with the rain, that doesn't mean the danger goes away. And we saw that notably down in Southern California in the Thomas Fire area. Lots of mudslides in the Montecito area. And unfortunately, the aftermath of the fire can be just as dangerous as the fire because you can have unstable debris flows that develop. I would say that certainly something we're going to be watching through this winter, and we're taking steps to look at those areas and see where the hazards are, and you know, maybe we might be placing some observation equipment out there just to help us get weather information, you know, to sort of supplement what we already have, and just really watch those areas as the wet season develops and try to give people alerts and let them know if we see some situation where there could be mudslides or debris flows that are going to develop. And that's something we might put watches out or warnings if we see something developing in the shorter term.
Well, Eric Kurth from the National Weather Service in Sacramento, thanks so much for sharing your time and expertise with us here on Blue Dot.
Oh, you're very welcome, Dave. It was nice to talk to you.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. When we come back, we'll continue our look at the science of wildfires. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our next guest is a longtime friend, our very own oceanographer and climate scientist emeritus, William Patzert. Bill retired from NASA last year, but he's been studying the role of climate on drought and fires in California for decades and joins us via Skype from his Southern California home. Bill Patzert, welcome once again to Blue Dot. Yesterday, I watched a press conference with Ryan Zinke, who's the Secretary of the Department of the Interior, and Sonny Perdue, who's the Secretary of the Department of Agriculture, who's in charge of the United States Forest Service, and our local representative. And they were talking about the car fire up here in Redding. And, you know, they were really discussing the problem as being one of the fuels being so loaded. But there also was, you know, an interjection from a reporter about the climate change being part of it. And I thought it was interesting because Secretary Zinke did say, you know, he didn't want to get into a climate change debate. He did say, though, that, you know, the temperatures are warming and we're getting longer dry seasons and shorter winter wet seasons. So I would like to pose it to you. Is climate change having much of an effect on these fires, do you think?
Well, you know, Dave, I've been talking about climate change for decades, and but it's more than talking about it now. We're living it. California is getting warmer, and Central and Southern California are certainly getting drier. Now, looking back in history, you know, the history of California is written in great droughts, great floods, and of course, great fires. But now the situation has turned into a crisis. And in particular, we're in a fire crisis here in the American West. You know, these fires are coming earlier. They're all year round. They're more punishing. And they're becoming deadlier. So fire is definitely a serious problem here in the American West. And there are a number of elements that essentially have brought us to this situation. The climate is changing. We're definitely warmer than we were 50 years ago. And it's had a powerful impact on the ecosystems up and down the state. The great forests are moving to higher altitudes. The groundwater levels are dropping. And, you know, so there are 200 million dead trees in the great National Forest here of California, and that has provided a tremendous fuel load that is essentially driving these fires.
So when I look at the wildfire situation, it seems to me that there's three main problems, and I'd like to go through those with you. Let me just list them, and then you can address them one by one. You've already mentioned climate change, which I think is kind of, it's just kind of an added push to the whole thing. But underlying that is about 150, you know, 120 years or so of fire suppression policy in the West, where we've taken ecosystems that were evolved to burn on a regular basis. And we know that the Native Americans deliberately set fires to clear out areas, and they did that at certain times of year in order to improve the hunting grounds where they lived, things like that. But we know that fire was just a natural part, you know, created by lightning. And that the forests would burn, but they wouldn't be cataclysmic fires. So you have, especially in California, you have plants that have evolved that are adapted to fire, especially there in Southern California. And then on top of that, though, you have this fire suppression policy that's now allowed, you know, for decades, this vast buildup of fuels. And then on top of that, you've got what Wallace Stegner addressed in many of his writings, that we have settled the West, a place that is arid and really not meant to be settled. And we've taken it one step further, because now we have our homes, many, many homes, sitting in this interface between urban areas and wild areas, where we're literally putting the homes in harm's way because people want to live where there's trees and it's pretty and you've got a view. So I look at it as all of those things together are creating this just disastrous mix.
Well, I think you've hit it right there. First of all, you mentioned forest ecology. These great forests are meant to burn. Actually, they're healthier when they burn every 20 to 40 years. I keep reading about these fires that have been breaking out last year and this year. And these are old forests that haven't burned in 100 years. And that's wrong. That's bad forestry management. These forests should be allowed to burn. So in a way, the culprit here is Smokey the Bear. We're having larger, more destructive fires, but in actual fact, when you count the numbers, we're having a smaller number of fires. And so there is really something wrong with the way we're managing not only the forests, but also the wildlands. And in the wildlands, where the urban-suburban wild interface is, there have been a lot of invasive plants, in particular grasses, which are extremely dangerous for fire. And so in a way that we've invited these large destructive fires. And so we have to seriously think about how we manage, especially not only the forests, but the wildlands here in Southern California, and actually in many places in Northern California. But what happened? In the 1950s, there were only 10 million people in California. Now there's 40 million. So when the population of the United States doubled, the population of California quadrupled, all right? That means there's a tremendous demand for housing here in California. As we all know, it's driven the price of houses high. And people are building in what I call wildfire corridors, where historically we did not build before. And we're building the same as we do in the urban environment. Now, that's all wrong. First of all, we're not clearing enough defensible space around these new communities that interface with the national forests and the wildlands. And we're not building right. You can actually build in these areas to more fireproof your home, okay? So essentially what we're doing in California is we're living dangerously. I keep reading these reports about these communities that are threatened or burned by fires over and over and over again. And so it's a combination of forest ecology, tremendous population growth, demand for housing, living in dangerous areas where historically we did not build, and how we build. Essentially, we have to change the zoning requirements as well as the building requirements if we build in these high-risk communities. And so it's not just climate change. It's essentially we have not adapted to the environment that we live in. Because as I mentioned earlier, the history of California, when you go back, is written in great fires, great floods, and great droughts.
Well, and when you talk to people who have lived in California a long time, you know, an attitude that you hear is, well, you know, this is nothing new. We've always had fires. It seems to me that these are a little bit, well, a lot different than the fires that I remember when I was younger, where these seem a lot more extreme. And one of the things that I've noticed was, for example, we're seeing more of these pyrocumulus clouds here in the West. I was out in the Caribou Wilderness, east of where I live, and I was with my daughter, Tiana, and she's a hydrologist with the United States Forest Service in the Eagle Lake District. And we were out on this lake together, and we were just looking at the view, and then suddenly something caught her eye, and I noticed her looking at it, and I started looking at it, and we kind of looked at each other, and it dawned on us, there's no cumulus clouds anywhere in the sky except right there. And she just said, you know, I think that's a pyrocumulus cloud, Dad. And I said, you know, I'm looking at it, I think you're right. So she immediately, because we were at a cell phone service, she hiked to the top of the peak above the lake we were at, like lickety-split, because she wanted to get in touch with her supervisors and find out what was going on. And sure enough, that was the Whaleback fire up by Susanville. And so she's been, you know, working on that with as part of her responsibilities with the Forest Service. But that pyrocumulus cloud was just kind of frightening. And I've seen that. I saw one of those at the over Lassen Park for the Reading fire back in 2012, I believe it was. So we're seeing these massive fires now.
Yeah, pyrocumulus phenomena. It's a particularly frightening one, especially for the firefighters. It's an example when the fire burns so intensely, creates so much heat, it actually creates its own meteorology, usually around mid-afternoon. And then as the day cools, these great pyrocumulus clouds can collapse. And when they do, they create winds that go off in unpredictable in directions 360 degrees as possible. And these are the kinds of conditions where firefighters are often trapped, and we often see deaths among the firefighters. And so these great fires now, which are fueled by these fuel loads, which really should have burned 40, 50 years ago, are creating extremely dangerous conditions for the firefighters.
Well, then I was speaking to our engineer and producer, the man on the board, Nolan Ford, prior to our interview. And Nolan basically wanted to know, okay, well, you know, I understand all these problems and stuff, but what do we do about it? So what are some solutions? You know, what can we talk about? What can we do? Because throwing our hands up in the air and saying, oh, well, this is just the new normal, and, you know, climate change is causing this, and so we're just going to have these massive fires and California's going to be destroyed. That doesn't seem to me to be a very productive attitude. What can we practically do about this?
Well, climate change is like a great supertanker. It in itself is hard to turn around in the short term. You know, that is the 40 to 100-year timeline, where we wean ourselves off fossil fuels and try to stabilize the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But the ecology management of the wildlands and the forests are something we could do immediately. We need more prescribed burns, all right? We need less invasive species in the wildland-urban interface. we have to zone our new communities, which seem inevitable because of the tremendous population explosion, but they have to have larger defensible areas around them. And if you choose to move in these dangerous, high-risk areas, then you have to have a different type of construction than you do in urban areas, so that the when you have these embers blowing into these communities, they won't catch fire so rapidly. So there's a lot we can do. But people have been careless about this because, you know, there's a most important thing in California, which really drives the economy, is it should be water, but it's not water. It's unfortunately, it's real estate. And real estate is so precious here in California, but we haven't been very thoughtful about these new communities we're building in dangerous areas.
Well, we're out of time, but I'd like to thank you once again, sir, for joining us. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Bill Patzert, our oceanographer, climate scientist emeritus here at Blue Dot.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Nolan, Dave. And hang in there, you know, because the fire season has just begun.
We hope you learned a lot from our look at wildfire science. I know I did. Thanks for listening. And thanks so much to our guests, Natasha Stavros from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, forecaster Eric Kurth from the Sacramento office of the National Weather Service, and our very own Bill Patzert, the Kahuna, retired NASA oceanographer and climate expert. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Check out and share this and past episodes on mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to us, Blue Dot, on NPR Podcasts. We are distributed via PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I'm Dave Schlom, reminding you out there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.